the expression from the music inspired me so much to take risks, and it inspired damn near the whole rap game.
Hello again, I'm Adam Ons. You may know me as the host of The Opus, and now I'm bringing my own show, The Spark Parade, to the Consequence Podcast Network. I speak with artists and creatives about the cultural artifacts that spark their personal interest and creativity, whether it's music, books, movies, video games, or any other kind of art.
I've never spoke about it in this amount of detail. I'm suddenly going, oh my God, I'm blowing my own mind here, Christ. It's actually a giant part of my life.
By talking about the things we love, we share and discover insights into our personality and the things that drive us.
It's just magic, really. I mean, frustrating. And it makes some people angry, but I don't think anyone's ever done anything like it.
I speak with people like Connor Roberts, Phoenix's Thomas Mars, Chris Gethard, Helen Hong, Adrian Young, and more, so their sparks of inspiration can start a fire in you.
I'm grateful for those who continue to put our history and who we are as a people in the forefront and make you see it.
Find the Spark Parade wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey pod people, Engineer Adam here, jumping in for a quick second to let you know about the brand new all-in-one platform for all of you creative podcasters out there. Anchor makes it easier than ever to make a podcast. It's free to use and has all the creation tools you need to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Plus, Anchor will get your podcast set up on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are found. Even better, Anchor helps you connect with sponsors, even if you're just starting out. It's the perfect choice for podcasters, so make sure to check it out. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. That's anchor.fm. Back to the show.
The kids on Elm Street don't know it yet, but something is coming to get them.
There's something out there, isn't there?
Halloween's a Freddy Krueger podcast.
Was locked in a room with a girl who went in alive and came out in a rubber bag.
From the Consequence Podcast Network, the minds behind The Losers Club, comes a new podcast in fantasy terror.
Nancy, there's something wrong with you. You're imagining things.
Halloweenies, a Freddy Krueger podcast.
Consequence Podcast Network.
To all of you beautiful pod people out there, I am your host once again, Leo Phillips. That's my name. And this Must Be the Gig. That's the name of the podcast. It's your little backstage pass to the world of live music. Each and every single week, I bring you a fascinating conversation from the beating heart of the live music and performance scene. And that could really mean chatting to a musician, picking the brains of a festival founder, sounds terrible, talking to a choreographer, a comedian, an actor, really anybody who is just as obsessed with performance the way that we are. But before we dig into this week's fantastic interview, which I am so excited by, let's check in with our constant companion here at TMBTG Studios, Engineer Adam. Hello!
Hey!
What's going on in Engineer Adam's world?
It is a world. It's a whole beautiful, dazzling world.
A place where...
dreams come true. Yeah. Well, I know last week we talked about how there was a new iPod and how excited I was. Mm-hmm. And then this week they go and kill off iTunes.
I mean, they're yanking, baby. They're yanking.
In the words of Scott Aukerman, iPod, iTunes, I don't know anymore. I'm just ripping off jokes, that's all. But even though iTunes may be dead, you can still find us on Apple Podcasts.
Is that what you were going to say?
Well, I was going to say Apple Podcasts will still exist, so yeah. You can still find us there.
Although iTunes aren't dead, we are inside you.
Oh my gosh. We are inside you, dead?
Oh God. Oh Lord. I'm like a human Ouija board right now.
Oh my God. But in addition to finding us on Apple Podcasts, you can also find us on all of the social medias at TMBTGpod or at Lior Phillips.
I can't keep it in anymore. We are rebranding.
Hey, so look out for all of that biz soon.
That's going to be soon. Don't know yet, but it's soon.
In the meantime, you could still leave us a note both at our show pages and at Lior's pages all over social media.
What about your pages?
Sure, leave
Adam
me a note.
I just want to tell everybody that Adam has just posted for the first time on Instagram since 2016. May we have a round of applause?
Thank you.
Wait,
thank
I'm
you.
or how does a ghost
applaud? No, that was the world's smallest applause. I appreciate it.
I was being a ghost because I'm dead inside.
Wow, you're really tying it all together.
Yeah, trying here, you know?
But also, it would really be a big help, and you have to do it. If you're listening to this, you have to do this. It's a rule. It's a law. Don't break the law. You have to do this.
We don't make the rules.
No.
Just follow them.
The government did. Which government? I don't know. Podcast jail for you if you don't leave
us
a five-star review.
Do you know that podcast revenue is now into, like, the millions?
Not ours.
I just want to tell you. Not ours. I read an amazing article today about how podcast revenue is just growing. And then I was listening to WTF and David Letterman was on, who, if you know me, I love David Letterman. And he was like, Mark, I've never listened to a podcast before. So
don't be like David Letterman.
No, be like David Letterman in terms of his aesthetic. His don't take no shit attitude and jangly beard.
But don't be like him in terms of not listening to podcasts. So listen to our podcast.
I mean, they're listening already. They're
in. Continue. Leave us a five-star review on Apple
Podcasts.
Well,
actually, I have a point. The only way that they can continue... So they're listening to this, but the only way they can continue is if they listen to leave a review, because other people will have to find us.
Yes.
So basically, leave a breadcrumb and people will eat us.
Yes. We're ghosts that are being eaten. This is the most important thing to take away from this. No, but seriously, don't go to podcast jail. Leave us a five-star review on Apple Podcasts. Share us on Spotify, on Stitcher. Wherever you listen to your podcast, other people need to hear us. So go out and do it now. And we will give you a shout out on the air. Every week we do this. So this week's shout out goes to Eddie Lothar. Hope I'm pronouncing that right. Mm-hmm. Who left this wonderful note on Apple Podcasts.
Oh, I haven't read this one.
This is a great long form interview podcast exclusively with musicians and singer-songwriters. Well, maybe. We'll see. We've got some tricks up our sleeves.
No, but Eddie's got a point.
There aren't enough podcasts out there like this, Eddie continues, so I'm glad I just discovered it. Luar Phillips is a great host interviewer, too.
Oh, bless. Thanks for that. Bless your heart and my imposter syndrome.
Thanks for those wonderful words,
Eddie.
Thank
you, Eddie.
Thank you. You're great.
So let's get to one of those long-form interviews, shall we?
Yes, we shall.
This week, our guest is Megan Remy, the experimental pop mastermind, better known as US Girls. Yes, that pause was intended so that you can have a little heart flutter.
Let it
like
sink
I
in.
Did. I caught up with the Illinois-born, Toronto-based singer-songwriter, producer, everythinger, before her Moogfest set a few weeks ago. And I am absolutely still on the regularly returning to her 2018 record In a Poem Unlimited. I just cherish those prisms of idiosyncratic songwriting. Megan is just as beguiling in person. She shifts to fascinating new threads of conversation that perfectly fits her really beautiful, soft-spoken brilliance. And there's just something so soothing about her voice that I think you all will share the excitement over and revel in that. It's a perfect counterpoint to the taut and coiled intensity of her record. And yet rather than being lulled, she draws you in for a really wonderful, complex conversation where we chat about
growing your own vegetables.
Our own vegetables.
I love that part too. You also talk about her going to see Billy Joel as a child and having his shoes tied.
Spoil it now.
I mean, it was at the Rosemont Horizon, a venue I'm very familiar with.
I think the best part of this whole conversation is how throughout you were just saying, oh, I've been there. I've been there. So if you are from Chicago born and bred, reach out and let us know, because you'll probably feel very at home in this podcast.
You also talk about her moving to Canada, about her ideal touring schedule. It's just really a sort of lifestyle conversation about what it's like to be a touring musician today.
But let us not be delayed. This is me and Megan. Enjoy! See you next week. Do you feel like in an ideal world that you would be able to tour for a certain portion of the year and then have it done with?
I feel like ideally it would be that it was up to when I wanted to perform. Not to some, like, you have to do this amount of time in a year. So either get it all done at once or spread it out over the year. Like, maybe I want to play 100 shows. Maybe I want to play 200 shows. Maybe I want to play 4 shows. It will be up to me and, like, my body of work and what's I want
to
do.
Yeah, as opposed to just, like, here is a tour, you have to do it
the
now.
Cycle and the equation of capitalism that seems to,
Tell me a little bit about your show, because I know we chatted about it off mic, but it would be great to hear how it actually went.
I think that it was a great show. It's the kind of show that sometimes you have to play where you show up and then you don't get a sound check, which seems to be most festival shows.
Really? You have no sound check?
Well, we could have had a sound check if we wanted to show up at 12 a.m., but that would have meant we would, or 12 p.m., but that meant we had to leave Atlanta at 5 a.m. or something. Yeah. And we didn't get home to go to bed till 1 a.m. or something. So you're like, we need sleep.
Yeah.
Because if you don't sleep, you can't play well. And if you don't sleep, you can't drive and you can't function. So you choose sleep over a sound check, which means then you roll into a situation where you're trying to present your work that you want to present. Mm. And the infrastructure that's supposed to be helping support the work and you presenting the work is often good intentioned, but scattered and like, but then it's fine because you're still being able, you're given a platform to present your work, and that's a privilege. So you're like, you get upset and frustrated. Yeah, but you get upset and frustrated for a minute, and then you try to gain perspective, and then just go forth. And so we did that, and we had a nice show with nice people there, and just you forego even a line check. We didn't line check anything.
Wow. So what are the biggest challenges you find, especially with this makeup and having so many bodies on stage with you? What is the biggest challenge other than
space?
Like,
space is the challenge.
Yeah,
because the clubs that we're playing often are small, like this evening, so small stage size, and like at the max, on average the max is a 4 mix thing, so the guitarists play without a monitor, and only a couple people get monitors, so which is like just like practicing in your jam space, so you're already used to it, but that's hard too, because within a body of work you have players who are also trying to present their work, which is their playing.
Then
say like tonight our saxophonist can't hear himself, that's very frustrating for him as a performer, when it's like his job and what he wants to do is to play the saxophone, and that's what he's devoted his whole life to. And then what matters often at festivals is just what matters happens before the festival even happens. So it's the tickets are sold, and then the music and everything else is secondary. And oftentimes they do a good job of programming good things, good music. Festivals will have interesting artists do installations or talks like you did and things like this.
Yeah.
But
it's not easy, I suppose, as a model. No, you're
the side. You're just like the... I don't even know what the right word is for what we are within the festival machine, you know?
I love that you said that it's a secondary thing, because I think that not a lot of artists would, like, admit that.
And it's embarrassing because I'm admitting that I'm complicit.
But I don't think it's that. I think that depending on what the point of the festival is, like, what I find quite interesting is lately there's a lot of festivals that are doing this like 360 idea, so there's podcasts, there's movies, there's talks, there's they're almost catering to this or pandering to an audience that needs a lot now, whereas before you go to a festival and it's just bands on the bill, you just go see music and then that's it.
But I think it's I understand what you're saying, but I do think that more who's to blame is the corporation and that equation, not the audience. They're casting out a big net because they're saying, we see what's popular right now, and if we cast out a big net, we're going to catch enough fish. to make it worth running this boat out in the middle of the ocean. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And yeah. So it's just, it's not, the audience doesn't want to have their brain split like podcast.
Yeah.
Like movie. They don't want that.
Yeah.
But whatever, everyone's been sold something. Mm. So everyone has a line that like this corporate, I don't know, you know, I wish there was a better word than corporation, but it's kind of like overall power thing, this power claw that hangs over us, whatever it is.
Well, it's a horrible visual, but it's like being stuck in that little thing with the claw machine and the toy. And then not being like,
but you're paying to be in it. And that's the thing. So you put your quarter in and then you go and you're a prize in the thing. So it's even worse than you even ever thought when you started that metaphor, because it's horrifying.
It's such a good metaphor, though. And I'm only
the Matrix. You know what I mean?
I giggle when I get nervous, but I'm nervous about that idea because it's so true. Yeah.
It's really scary. It's a hard thing because it makes reality rub in a way where I really feel it. And I've felt that rub in reality many times in my life. Like, and I think that's why I like performing, because performing makes it rub in a big way, because you are, because of the fourth wall and because of you're someone who is just like everybody else who in who you're looking at, you know, because if you're on a stage you're looking at some people, sometimes no people, but even if there's no people you're imagining a people there, so you're looking into others' eyes, and like to be alive means that like you shit, and if you're lucky you shit, and like, you know, and so, but to go on a stage means that there's you're one layer up, or you know, they make you want to believe it's one layer up because of the way the world we live in is hierarchical thinking, you know. I don't think it's one up. I think it just means if you can get the thing where a fourth wall becomes between you and another person, or lots of people, or a few people, then you get to have a different perception of the moment that everyone's experiencing.
Right.
So some people would think that that's the quest for power. You know what I mean? That's what power is you want to have a different perspective that's more unique or exclusive.
But do you feel like when you started performing, because obviously along the trajectory of your career, when you started performing, of course you're going to have a different shift. It's going to shift continuously, whether it's the audience helping you shift, whether it's your personal internal growth, whether it's the music you're making. So along all the years, what do you feel like was the biggest shift for you, and where did that come from, where you thought, wow, okay, I'm actually doing this full time. I'm an artist. This is my work.
The shift just always came from me, for sure. Always, and was always of the same potency. It's never been a different potency of any step.
Yeah.
So each kind of awakening with something around performance or art has always been the same potency. It's just a different color.
Yeah.
They're all like full pigment or something. So for me, I always make a kind of, when I think about, for me with art, it's like the sketch of where our ancestors grow up to walk.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's the evolution. Like,
yeah. And how no step is greater than the other. You couldn't, the evolutionary stage that we're at now would not exist without the first step. So to act like this one's better than that is absurd.
Yeah. you can't have success in that way.
Yeah, but you can't have one without the other.
I really appreciate that point, because I think measuring success as an artist is so strange. Because what are you measuring it against if not yourself? And then if you're looking at your past, how hard is that to look at your past and go, oh, well, look at me now, I'm so much better. That is so dangerous.
Well, because everyone...
But it's human nature.
Sure. And it's human nature to not acknowledge, or to know but not acknowledge in all of our behaviors that we're going to die, you know? Right. So to make a big deal out of any sort of step of success or evolutionary stage, it's like that first step of evolution died.
Yeah.
And as will we. So there's a kind of a flattening of all time and all things and all stuff that for me is helpful, but also is creates, like I said, that psychic kind of reality rub where it allows me to do maybe these things that I know are totally foolish, because it's like, why not?
Yeah, it's true.
It's like,
do you think making art is foolish?
No, not at all. I think it's a pretty sane thing to do. I think it's like a healthy thing that a lot of people do. And some people do it for very short periods of their life, sometimes their whole life. Mm. If you're a dabbler or you're like an expert, it doesn't matter. Like, it's a foolish thing that's healthy, I think. But I think that you should always know that it's foolish. Never lose sight of that seriously. Foolish thing.
But I love that, because there's so much work that I feel like I just, with my, I can't call her a therapist, but my coach.
Yeah,
she's
yeah.
She's more like a facilitator.
For sure.
And she does like BWRT. I don't know if you've heard of BWRT. So it's like brain reworking therapy.
I know about it, but under a different name, because I've done cognitive behavioral therapy, and right now I do somatic therapy.
So it's similar to that, and it's mind-blowing how the concept of, like, you can literally encase your body in that idea of fun or fear, of course, and when you have something really challenging, like a performance that you're really nervous about, if there's, like, you know someone's going to be there and you really want to make sure that it's great, or you know for yourself that it means a lot for you, and having that frivolous attitude, because I feel like sometimes we get so caught up in taking things too seriously, which I feel like the beautiful balance, which I don't know where you are at, but as I am only relating from my point of view, is that I'm trying to see big moments and challenging experiences as fun. But like, you can still be professional. You can still be serious. Sure, you can still like do your job very well. But to enjoy it, that enjoyment has kind of left a lot of people's lives lately, whether that's political or what have you, or personal. So
I don't even know if it's lately left.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's always been gone. I don't know. That's a whole...
Yeah, it's strange. It's very interesting. But so let's go back to where you mentioned that you grew up in. Where did you grow up? In, did you say?
I grew up in Illinois.
Illinois.
Yeah.
In Joliet.
Joliet.
And then you moved. When did you move to Toronto?
Not till the end of 2010.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Why? What made you want to go?
Cause I met someone and like fell in love with them and wanted to be with them all the time and see them and stuff. So that was the main reason for sure. Mm-hmm. And I think like a subconscious knowing that like I needed to get out of living in America and that I was lucky to be able to get out.
Absolutely.
So I lived for a while in Canada, like 2 years and a bit. I'm not sure how long, but where I couldn't be there longer than 6 months, and you just like go back and forth and do that whole dance.
The visa,
if you're lucky enough to get to do, you know, because a lot of people are just denied the entry to the place they want to go.
Absolutely.
So any of my immigration woes have been really non-existent. They've been, if I'm being honest, like hurdles I had to pay through, you know what I mean? And I can admit that I'm lucky enough for that. And like, but at the same time, I can acknowledge just how absurd it is, how arbitrary, and like how countries are, the whole thing is, relates back to that death thing, you know? Like, it's like why you want to put boundaries on things. Let's try to have some sort of control over something where there is no control. But, Canada, it really changed everything for me. So, but it's not even Canada. Like, Canada, the thing that it is, I don't respect. but I respect the people that live there. And
right,
like, you know,
yeah.
Same as with America, you know.
Yeah. So tell me, what was your first... Do you remember the concert that you went to, the first ever concert?
I do.
What was that?
It was Billy Joel.
What? What?
Yeah.
That's amazing. I love Billy Joel.
Yeah. Was at the Rosemont Horizon, mm-hmm. which is like north of Chicago. It's called something else now, you know, as these arenas all change. They get bought
depending
out.
Depending on the sponsorship.
They change, but it was Rosemont. I think the town is Rosemont. I'm not sure, though, but it's north of the city. I think maybe you take 94. I don't know what highway you take, but...
Yeah, 94. That sounds
familiar.
It
might be 94, way north, but...
Yeah.
My parents were there, and I'm pretty positive both my brothers were there. And I remember that I had a, like, kind of nylon windbreaker on that had an apple applique on it. And someone spilled a beer on me that was, sitting behind us. And Billy Joel's shoe got untied on stage, and Christie Brinkley came up and tied it.
What?
It was like the whole concert stopped for her to come
to
tie,
come
his,
tie
shoe.
His shoe. Why could he not tie his own shoe?
I mean, because he's a child.
Oh my.
He's a baby.
Billy Joel, what the fuck?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
I think they
God.
They must have done it every night. It had to
like a little thing.
It had to be part of it. Because everyone wanted to see her because she was in Uptown Girl or whatever. I think Uptown Girl. So
she came in and had to be the on the floor tying his shoe like a servant.
I remember like a light like came on her. Like my memory can't really be trusted around that. But I do think it was that. I think I was 4 years old.
And then do you remember the time that it all... Because I hate asking the question, like, your first moment that memory of music kind of burst. But I'm kind of more interested in when the time that you figured out that it was absolutely what you wanted to do, you know, that was an extension of you. Was that when you were younger?
I was younger. I always loved music. It was always important to me. I never had music lessons, but I... danced in my room and sang in front of the mirror and watched a lot of music videos.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, endless. I watched MTV from 3 p.m. till I went to bed every night. Even all the
the reruns as well. There was
all the shows they started. That was the beginning of reality TV, and that was my youth. Like,
me too.
And the reality TV of news, where it was like, I didn't even like Nirvana. I didn't. I like Boyz II Men. And when Kurt Cobain died, still was like, this guy died. Like, it's just like when Jimi Hendrix died, or you could relate it to this kind of cultural history that it really was so documented with photo, audio, video, film. It was really the first kind of, we really live in the, I don't know how long it will last, but the beginning of a kind of encyclopedic and documented culture in this way that's the it's realism documented, so real as real as visuals can get.
But did
on
you
that kind of stuff.
Like what you, because I just remember MTV came to South Africa and it was everything for me. It was, I would literally run, drop my bag, throw my suitcase, run upstairs, turn the TV on faster than the TV could actually go on. And then my main video that I always remember was the No Doubt video, the Don't Speak video.
Oh my
that
God,
was
it was
like,
huge. It was huge.
That was nonstop. That was maybe a year or two after. That was 97. So that was a year or two after I think it all started.
Mm-hmm.
But is there a video that you remember just like that one that really stuck out for you?
Well, I remember so many videos. But the one that comes to mind mostly was Remember the Time by Michael Jackson. Because my mom let me stay home from school. Because it was premiering.
And
I lived on Central Time, it was premiering on Eastern Time, and there was a call-in thing where you could try to win, and my mom let me stay in for the whole day, even though it was like an hour at the, I could have missed a half day or something to try and just call a busy number for hours, because it was like Pepsi or I don't know who was, it might have just been MTV sponsoring, but you could win tickets to go see Michael or something. That was the first time I ever saw Iman. And that was before I knew who David Bowie was, for sure. But it was like, him on. And Eddie Murphy was in the video. Yeah. And like,
that's such a,
it was a good song. I liked that song. And it seemed, I think it, you know, but which now is very difficult to say, you know. I know. But
he was my, well, like my first concert. It's very hard to say. Yeah. It's very difficult to admit it.
Yeah.
But do you, going back to the time where you were watching the videos and dancing and singing, did you ever envision yourself as that, or was it just an outlet for you at the time? No.
The only way I envisioned myself was like doing it in front of my school. Yeah. You know, and I was like, I'm going to like do this talent show in front of my school, or I'm going to like have a choreography and then everyone at school is going to like me. But that's the same as wanting like whatever to pursue some sort of public thing. If you want your school to like you, you know, so... But I did a lot of calling. I called into radio stations a lot.
Why? What was that?
To
was
sing this on the radio.
And did you?
Lots. 104.3 Oldies, like Oldies 104.3 was a station in Chicago, FM station, and I called in a lot. Yeah.
Do you remember?
After school. Were Beach you singing? Boys, always Beach Boys.
What
Be
that
true
you were
to
singing?
Your school, Barbara Ann. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, honestly, to picture a mini you calling in and so excited and just singing your heart out.
Yeah.
That takes so much, like singing to an invisible audience as opposed to like an audience in front of you. I think it's so much harder to do that. It's like it's like studio work versus performing.
But it was totally anonymous.
Yeah, okay. Know? So nobody, you weren't like, hello, it's me.
No, you're just, they would ask your name and you'd say, but they knew you were a kid. So
yeah.
They'd, like always put you on if you're a kid. Like without a doubt, like if you're a kid, kids should always call the radio station. They'll put you on.
Yeah.
Especially if it's an oldies station. You
know,
like
they're gonna eat that up, of course.
Yeah.
So then do you remember the first time you performed? Do you remember that first concert?
The first concert I ever performed. I wasn't I performed in weird things before I ever played. Like I played Sandy in Grease, but in a fashion show.
Oh.
So it was like a
She's stylish.
It was like a fashion show for local boutiques or something to put stuff on the runway. But then they had little entertainment in between the clothes stuff. And I lip synced to whatever the you're the one that I want.
Yeah.
And this guy played Danny Zuko, obviously. And we lip synced to the song. And so that was my first kind of musical performance. First time I played a show was, oh God, I don't even know. I can't say what my first show was.
Mm.
I know I played a VFW hall?
No.
It's like a veterans hall
that
you can rent out.
Okay.
Like, I played some of those kinds of things maybe when I was 14. I was in, like, some bands in high school, first year high school. I wish I could remember what my first show was, because I know I did open mic night things, too, where you would just go make a fool of yourself or whatever, but I don't know what my first real show was, because I think I was just always putting on shows.
Yeah. Do you feel like, when was the time then that you decided to write your own music? When did that shift happen? Because performing versus creating is very different.
I think I was 13 years old, maybe, when I really started writing songs. Until, through early high school. And I would say during that time, most songs no one ever, would see or hear or anything like that, right? But I did make tapes in high school. My band had tapes and CDs and things like that. But I do know I wrote songs as a very young child, just like singing them to yourself, because you would hear a song on the radio and then you would just be so moved by it that you wanted to make something like it. So then you just like sing words that you write that are the same melody but just slightly off or something.
Was there a performer, though, that you looked to that maybe you had seen or heard of that you felt, that is exactly how I want to be? That's how want people to feel, the same way I'm feeling towards them.
For sure. When I got, I ordered this VHS off on like a mail order thing. It was all Riot Girl bands, and it was like from, I think most of the footage was from like a Riot Girl festival that happened in Olympia or Centralia, Washington or something like this. And Heavens to Betsy played, which was like Sleater-Kinney before Sleater-Kinney, and just all these bands that I don't even know if they have records, but that was what really clicked with me. It was a really shitty VHS, like from far away, of these people performing with really bad sound. You know, like I can look back on it now, I'm like, it didn't sound good technically in some kind of just technical way, but the spirit and everything was just so good. And it was cool because it felt to me like the same spirit of soul music that I loved, where and girl group music, that was the stuff I really loved as a kid, and Motown, like so much, but it was like the soul of that, but really making do. You know what I mean? Like, we don't have any money or technical ability or money for gear. We can't just help to like just like emit something that's just like extra in existence. So
it's funny because you've also in some of the things that I've read, and you've mentioned Crass as being such a big influence. And I had Tim Burgess from The Charlatans on, and he actually mentioned that that was so big for him as well. And
that's cool.
It's so great that because that really happens, and I often don't broach the topic of influences because I find it so boxing to ask someone like, who are you influenced by? Like, it could be the world. And it is telling, of course. It's a great question, but I want to talk about Crass because I think that's so great that came up and has come up, because listening to your music and having that ethos and seeing, I've seen you perform before, it makes so much sense, you know. When did you find them?
I got into Crass, I think, like either 8th grade or first year of high school, so you're 13, 14 then. I had a like real punk boyfriend, and I had one friend at my school who was a punk, and I don't know which one of them turned me on to it first, or if I saw Crass imagery like on someone's back patch at a show, and then I saw it in a mail order, and then I ordered. I don't know what the trajectory was, but I had the Stations of the Crass CD, I think it was a double CD, and I just love them instantly. Even if I had only seen the imagery before I heard them, I love them already just from the imagery. It was the first punk music I heard that had men and women in it. I think it was the first stuff with women I had heard, and I had heard Crass and this band Blatz at the same time, who are a Bay Area band that were kind of the American pop punk version of Crass in a way. They had women and men in it, and different singing styles, and but political, but very humor based and sassy. So I think I thought Crass was a contemporary band for a really long time, until I got a shirt that was Crass, that was like Reagan and the Statue of Liberty Margaret Thatcher and someone else, but with punk bodies.
Yeah.
And then I was like, this is current. This is from old times, whatever.
Yeah.
And I cut the shirt off and turned into a back patch.
So great.
And all the collaging that the woman in Crass does, I'm forgetting her name, and I shouldn't, because she's like one of my favorite artists. But she did a lot of all their artwork and other people's artworks, and for their albums and that stuff, the collage, the realist collage stuff really blew my mind too. And just like political lyrics in a catchy way. They're very catchy.
And that
makes sense with Chumbawamba, you know what I mean? You're like, oh, you're so smart, like you just saw how fucked up everything was, but you gotta live, so you just like did this one hit.
And then that's it. And then you, like, left. You died. That was it.
Yeah.
But do you find, especially broaching topics like gender and politics and those things that are, like, expected of us, I always feel like, especially for women, you're always, like, meant to talk about all these things. Do you find that, like, you've had to speak and approach those topics a lot in the last few years of putting out albums and having to...
No, because I think you do better if you don't talk about that stuff. Yeah,
I agree.
No, I don't think I've never felt any pressure. I've felt pressure to think less about these things. So. Yeah. No.
So what are the things that matter for you?
I don't know, really. That changes every hour, I guess. Mm-hmm. For me, first and foremost, it's a mental health exercise. Always has been. For if that's good or bad, I'm not sure. You know, I think it's good.
Why would it be bad? You mean relying on it as a tool?
Or as an escape or something. Okay. You know what I mean? I think that some people do it as a negative mental health. Yeah. Because you can do something for your mental health that, like a security blanket's not necessarily a healthy thing to use, you know.
Sure, any crutch that you are reliant on that could easily have...
Covers up other stuff.
Sure.
You know.
Of course, but being raw and being open is sometimes, of course, you can't do that as well. Yeah. So having that balance.
Yeah.
And especially using something like art and like music as a blanket, I think is...
For sure. It's the best case scenario. You're not using like beating someone up or guns or like, or like an eating disorder or something.
Exactly. Yeah. Do you find like music fuels you in the same way that it always has? As you are, because you obviously, there's been so many different phases that you've been open to putting your music out there. Now that this album came out, I feel like you got so... rightfully deserved attention. Do you feel like your opinion of it has shifted a little,
like maybe the industry of music? Yes. But like I think that I've realized that for me it's not just music, it's like all mediums that of expression that is what I'm really interested in. So that hasn't been tainted at all, but an industry of music is I can say without a doubt since working with 4AD is when it's shifted for me. And not like they did it or something. It's just they work in an echelon of the industry that is, you know, it's a different ballgame than working with Silt Breeze, which was who I worked with at the beginning, which was, you know, it's kind of like, it's hard to go from... when your world operates on a handshake deal and a joke almost, you know what I mean? And then to be this other thing.
Contracts
where,
and things like that.
Yeah, and just like a whole different ball game, especially as a like someone who identifies as a female, like it's just a different.
But you said there's different modes of expression. Do you feel like, what other things do you turn to other than music to make sure that you are healthy? And
I read a lot. I consume people's, you know, writers' work in an immense amount.
Really?
Yeah. And read in a lot of theater and do a lot of thinking about theater. I try to see it when I can and when I can afford it. And
yeah, it can get so expensive.
I watch a lot of film and movies and things like that, and listen to music, obviously, always. And I just daydream a lot about doing other things.
Yeah, I love that concept. I was thinking about it the other day, how, like, with our lives being so busy and so crazy all the time, I feel like we've forgotten how to just sit and daydream like we used to. I feel like when I was younger, I could just sit in the back of my dad's car and just, like, look out the window and daydream about things.
Yeah.
And that's so important. But weirdly, I don't know if we had pressed play yet, but weirdly, we were chatting also about like the travel aspect of this job. And there is something about being suspended 10,000 feet or something in the sky that does give you that break to daydream, you know?
I used to feel that way about flying. I used to get on a plane and I would just fall asleep right away.
Yeah.
And I would be kind of in a bliss state, kind of in between no man's land. And I don't feel that way anymore. Like, flying to me now is... it feels bad.
Like,
just the experience of the airport. Like, going through checkpoints at an airport and seeing how, if you can just pay, you can kind of go through. And the incessant advertising and how expensive everything is. And then and the baggage shit, where it's like the cost of that, where it's like you're already paying so much for a ticket and and all the stuff, and then you get on the plane and then there's no food. It's like they'll maybe give you water, like, but you're flying like so long, and it's like, what if you can't afford the food in the airport? And like, it's just man. And then you're up in the air, and we were flying to LA the other day to start this tour, and we looked out the window and there was a plane, you know, when they're kind of coming on your level and you're like, fuck, is it coming towards us in the air? But they always miss because they have the geometry or whatever, algebra correct. And you can see the chemtrails in the sky. When you're close to them, they're black. You know, they're black. It is, airplanes are just spewing. These chemicals constantly into the air, and from the bottom, from the ground, they look white because of however light reflects on those chemicals from where we are.
So beautiful, and that far like away, you're like,
But when you're up close, they're black. And that is hard. That is hard. And just the whole thing of just, you, maybe you shouldn't be able to get everywhere you want to go. Maybe you shouldn't be able to have every fucking goddamn food you want to have at all times. You know, like. We're on tour and we do, you know, like we go spend our money. You know, you go to Whole Foods. You're like, I want a Whole Foods because it seems like it's like the better thing to do or organic. Something. You're like, but it's not. It's the same bullshit. Yeah, like, it's the they're same. Serving, the they got black plastic forks and like, you're just like, it's all coming from far away anyway. And it's just like, we should just be buying from people that are growing nearby, and maybe for all winter you can only have sweet potatoes and like not cabbage, have
bananas all like, year round. Like there's always bananas or like strawberries, and it doesn't make any sense because outside the trees are losing their leaves, and then you've got these bananas like always sitting in the shop in the supermarket.
It's too much.
But do you feel like you tackle your own life like that? You are very aware of what you're using and not using, and
I try, but no, it's to really be able to be aware and act, I mean, you have to have money. I mean, it really does for us. Like, we can't buy all organic, and we can't buy all local. We just actually can't, and we'd like to, and we try to buy as much things that aren't packaged or buy bulk. And like only buy like fish from Canada, and like, you know what I mean? Like, you try to do these things, but then it's like garlic. You know what I mean? Like, there's also the, like, where you have to go. You know what I mean? It's like, if you have to spend money or drive really far to get this stuff that's local garlic, is it, how does it weigh against just getting the garlic that's from China that's at your grocery store that you can walk to? I don't know, like, how what's the footprint better? All equals out in the end. So no one can be perfect. And
I think obviously going,
if you could grow,
growing everything yourself is, but obviously we don't all live in climates where we can do that. So that's also tough.
Or don't have the skills or the space or the, like where we live is on a really main drag in Toronto. And you're like, what would it be like to grow food here? Cause I clean my windowsills and they're black. You know what I mean? Like, is the food going to be okay with all this shit in the air? I don't know. Like, everything is, that's the thing. There's like, Max was just telling me about this article that he saw that was like where they had never, they're always doing research on the air outside, but they've never really done it on the inside of homes and things. And it's like,
oh my gosh, it's terrifying.
It's like the worst thing you can imagine. Like a toaster is like putting all this particulate in the air that's so bad. And like, they did this experiment where they cooked like three Thanksgiving dinners in a house, and then like the the air was like worse than New Delhi.
Oh my gosh.
And that's not even all the off-gassing of plastics, you know?
I always feel like everybody, especially because like fads are so great, especially with, you know, artists, they try, we all try and like reduce our carbon footprint. But as you said, it's so difficult when you need to just, you have to be at a show at a certain point of time and you need to get there. You can't just click a button. Europe, it's easier.
You could not play.
Yeah.
But then you're, you know, it's difficult. because the number one thing, like, there's many things driving climate change and where we live in, but like with the American military, like, if, unless that ends, none of this shit's gonna change. None of it.
Yeah.
Because the carbon footprint of the U.S. military is so massive that individuals could do all they want. And it won't really do much because of the...
what they're continuing to do. Yeah.
The energy it takes for all the bases around the world to continue being air-conditioned, lit, the food, the toilet paper, the Starbucks double shots and the Red Bull coming in and the Ambien and the fucking helicopters and the Hummers.
Yeah.
And when military are not in war, they're doing exercises that are just for the hell of it to prepare for war, because it's this incessant contract bidding and contract war that perpetuates this capitalist shit that's just like, it's, we're drowning in it. We're just
But I always feel like when you think about all of that, it just is so overwhelming sometimes, and then I just kind of want to cocoon myself and then not want to come out because I feel completely helpless. But I'm trying lately to feel that, even like, I used to get so upset with people like posting shit about like, oh, save the sign this petition and do this, but the truth is that you saying you should sign a petition is something more than doing nothing.
Do something. That's the thing.
And I think speaking about it now is doing something.
For sure.
Whether, irrespective of whether somebody listening is not doing anything, I feel like I hate feeling like I can't do enough. And I always feel like I'm not doing enough.
I think acknowledging things is insane.
Yeah.
Acknowledging a truth goes a long way. You know? There's nothing that I could ever do to make what the American experiment has been okay. Like, I could never say anything or do anything that could ever erase slavery and any contribution that, like, I've contributed to it, or any person in my family before, you know? But I can say,
yeah,
I know what slavery is, and I know what happened, and that's something. So I do think, always do something, say something, have the conversation. But then know, like, it's all, living is an exercise in frustration. And it's also just like a kind of weird thing where you're just like, I'm just doing this. And it's just going to end at some point. Could be we walk out of here and I get hit by a car. You know what I mean? Well, like, we don't know, but like,
you have to do
I could have everything planned. I could have the rest of my life planned. I could have children that are waiting for me. I could have the whole thing, and I could just. And we're also this one speck in a massive, massive, massive thing that we don't even know what that is, what space is. And
especially with music, I feel like people connect to it in such a way where it does bring that speck into perspective almost. It takes that speck and you're like, oh, I suddenly know who I am now. Because I always feel like when I was younger, listening to music allowed me to figure out who I was. You know, I didn't know how to feel until I put a song on, and then I was like, oh, that's, I feel happy, or like, you know, it like, it dictated the emotions. And I feel like sometimes when you are feeling overwhelmed and you are that little speck, sometimes reaching out to books and art and things like that helps you
get it, makes
that,
you present in the moment. So it's mindfulness, so you're just like, time is gone and everything else is gone, and you're in the moment, and that's what life is supposed to be. Not this planning for war or planning for retirement or planning for whatever the next weekend out. It's just a here and now. And
Because making music, I can imagine, and performing is a very present action. You cannot not be in the present. You absolutely have to be grounded in that. So do you feel like there's something about performing that you find... like, what, because I'm not really used, I don't want to ask you, like, what you do before a show, because of course it can totally change, but, like, especially, like, tonight, that's why I kept apologizing that we were talking after your show, because I don't know what anyone goes through, like, what is your process for you know, kind of, like, a decompress after such a...
I mean, it often doesn't really occur. When you're traveling with 8 or 9 people and you're sleeping 3 to 4 people to a room often, and the only time you're alone is when you're in the bathroom. There's no luxury of the decompression. It's just a kind of pressure cooker kind of thing.
Mm. So how do you make sure that you have time to yourself?
I don't on tour.
Just have to accept it.
I did when I toured alone. Mm. When I toured alone for many, many years and I traveled alone, I had a lot of alone time. That's why I liked it.
Mm.
I liked being on my own schedule and being alone at shows, performing and then being alone. Not really having anyone maybe you talk to the promoter, maybe you end up staying somewhere with someone that you could talk to a little bit, but it's a whole different thing now. It's just a whole different thing.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of alone time when I'm at home.
Yeah.
And I have a very rich inner life, so even when I'm surrounded, I'm often alone. So
yeah.
I do, there's always alone time for me in that sense, because I speak a language that no one else does, so,
Exactly.
I'm always talking with myself and having the dialogue that I need to have.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And lastly, because I'm sure you want to go to bed, how do you make sure that going forward you can do this forever? What are the tools that you're putting in place now to make you keep continually being creative or
inspired? I don't think I want to do this forever. Doing right now. No, I mean, I like talking with you. I don't mean that. I mean performing music in this kind of way. I'll have no problem being creative, because it's the very, if I'm not doing it, I'll be dead. You know, like, it really has been my reason for living. It's been my sustenance and all of that. If I stopped making stuff, there would be something wrong. Or it would be I had gone to a whole nother plane where I'm, like, existing on air and, I'm better. I'm doing better than I could have ever been doing making things. But for me, it's reading.
Mm.
Reading is the thing that just guarantees that I'm going to have continue having creative and critical thoughts, and like, for sure, reading is just...
What are you reading at the moment?
Right now I'm reading this one book that is basically equating maps and fiction writing. So it's crazy, and I got it at a thrift store in New Mexico, and it's because Rebecca Solnit has a quote on the back and she's like, I wish I had written this book, and I was like, okay, I'll try that, because I haven't read all she's written, but like, she's a smart cookie. So it was $2, so I got it, and it's incredible. So like, it's a very, I couldn't even begin to explain what it's all about.
Yeah. But
some of the things are like how a map influences what you then think of what you're seeing or whatever, you know, and how what you leave out is as important as what you put in.
Yeah.
And that's how fiction is. And
it's like world building. You're building that world. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So
that's so wonderful.
It's a really good book. So I'm reading that. I also got another book that I got at that same thrift store that was a novel written in 1980, put out in 1985 by a woman from Maine. Seemed to be her first novel. I don't know if it was her only one. I can't remember her name, but it's called The Beans of Egypt, Maine. So there's a town called Egypt, Maine, and it's about this family called the Beans, and it's incredible.
Oh, that's so great.
It's like some of the best fiction I've read in a while, with really a lot of capitalization and dialogue, where it's like people kind of yelling.
Yeah.
It's really cool. Wow. And I had a blast reading it, and it's mostly female characters, and they're really strong and messy and good.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. And I love that you just found that. Like a little treasure trove.
I hit the jackpot in Los Cruces, New Mexico. I also got a history of criminal justice and 2 books that were volume 1 and 2 called Her Life and Her Work or something, which is female writers compiling essays from them about their work.
Do you often tend to go toward female writers.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's just like, yeah. I tend to want, ideally, most of the things I like to consume are made by women. Mm, that has I'm to go same. With food yeah. and everything.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, it's not a prejudice thing, and I think men are equally can make wonderful things and stuff. It's just like a, I don't know.
Just a natural.
Safety, comfort, yeah. trust.
Relatability.
Relatability, familiarity. Respect, instant respect, you know.
Absolutely.
Like, I just trust a woman over a man any day.
Yeah, 100%. I yeah. agree. I think we should end off on that. That's a great point. Thank Sounds you so good. Much for, Thank for you. Being on the show. This Must Be the Gig is produced by Adam Kivel, and we'd like to thank Billy Yost and The Kickback for our theme song, Rube, and buy their music at thekickbackband.com. Lexi Frame for the artwork, Daniel Brater and Dean Berger for the additional sound design, and the Consequence Podcast Network, where you'll find a bunch of other amazing shows. If you've listened this far, why not go the extra mile and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts? Your comments provide valuable feedback for us, and it helps other people find us too. For information on new episodes, be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at TMBTGpod, and generally just irritate everyone you know about the show. Thanks again, and I miss you already.
Consequence Podcast Network.